What if you had to make the most important decision in your life today? In fact, you already have, at least for your life so far. We make decisions every day, but some of them can shape the course of the rest of our life. Intersections explores those decisions and their consequences. You choose to turn this way instead of that way. Why? And what happened next?
Welcome to Intersections.
Today I'm interviewing Daniel Wade, who really has had a succession of different identities, I think really cool identities. Here he worked once for the utilities department of the city of Oklahoma City, and he quit that job to work on a really big project. So, Daniel, usually I have people just kind of give me their elevator pitch. You just stepped on an elevator and, you know, somebody says, hey, what do you do?
Thanks for having me, Brett. I actually have two jobs now. My regular job is the president of a one-man engineering firm, which is water preservation and planning. I do computer modeling for water distribution systems. That's the boring part of my job. The other half of it is that I'm a one-man solar power research company now. I am currently working on a technology called the downdraft tower.
Wow.
And it is a new kind of solar generator that has really enormous potential for creating utility scale amounts of power cheaper than coal and natural gas.
Yes, and I did a story on that in the Oklahoma Gazette. Listeners, you can go to okgazette.com and read my story in there about Daniel's downdraft tower project. Now, Daniel, at the time I interviewed you for that story, you were still working. You were like at, I don't know, 50-some percent funding. First of all, tell us about how you funded that, and tell us what the outcome was.
Well, I've funded that by cashing in my 401k, but I started a Kickstarter campaign, which is an online fundraising campaign, to recoup some of my costs on that. I set out to raise $10,000 in 60 days, and when we talked for the Gazette, I was at about the halfway point.
Yeah.
And now I'm happy to announce the project is fully funded.
Wow. Matter of fact, you barely oversubscribed.
Yeah, I got about 5% on top of my goal, which was a great feeling.
That's amazing. Well, so Daniel, you've made a lot of different big decisions, sounds like to me. You made the decision to leave the city of Oklahoma City. You know, a lot of people would love to have a great stable job. You know, Oklahoma City is a great city to work for, aren't they?
Oh yeah, they're fantastic.
And I mean, every city employee I ever interview seems to be happy, feel like they're being treated fairly. So you left that job. You've obviously made a lot of different decisions. Before we get to the key question here, tell us a little bit about the downdraft dome, because I think that's a big idea. And so just kind of from 10,000 feet, what is the downdraft dome going to be?
Downdraft generation is something that some people call solar power, some people call wind power. It's a nice hybrid of the two. It works on the principle that when water is evaporated, it cools the surrounding air. And since cold air sinks, if you're able to contain this collection of cold air, mm-hmm. and get it going in the right direction, you can use that cold air to power some wind turbines. So what the downdraft dome does is sets up a geodesic dome, just like you'd see it at the Gold Dome at 23rd Street.
Yes.
or Epcot, if you're outside of Oklahoma City.
Uh-huh.
But this geodesic structure to support a shell which channels that cold air and pushes it through a wind turbine to harness the power of that evaporation.
Wow. And in case people think that you're talking about a geodesic dome like the Gold Dome at 23rd and Klassen, tell us your actual concept is going to take up
would take up how many square miles?
Oh, it would take up about an 8 or 9 square mile area. Ideally, these would be set up in the deserts where land is fairly cheap and evaporation is at peak performance. But the kind of domes that really make this technology cost effective are really enormous. We're talking mile-high domes. But the thing about a geodesic dome, unlike almost every other structure in the world, the larger a dome gets, the stronger it becomes.
Wow.
So it is, would certainly at a mile tall be the tallest structure ever created, but it would not be nearly as expensive as your average skyscraper, because all that dome is doing is serving as a structural support for what's on the inside.
For the tower
right. itself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the original concept was supposed to be concrete, but concrete, while it's strong, it's also very heavy, and it creates its own weight, which creates its own structure problems, right?
In civil engineering school, they tell us to be careful about concrete because it's very good compressive. It has very good compressive strength,
right?
But it has very poor tensile strength, the bending strength. If you had a thin rod of concrete, you could just snap it with your bare hands.
Right.
So the concrete towers that have been devised for downdraft technologies for decades only go so far. You can only build so high with concrete before it starts getting wobbly on
right.
you, and before you have to put more and more steel rebar into the concrete mm-hmm. for it to work. And after a while, you just can't go any higher.
Yeah, it just creates its own weight and its own structure problems just by its presence, right?
Exactly.
Just the taller you get, the more it just creates its own problems.
Right.
Yeah.
But a geodesic structure, as the taller it gets, the wider out it spreads. And
right.
I'm not here to lecture on structural engineering.
Right.
I'm going to put your listeners to sleep. But a geodesic structure is incredibly lightweight
right.
for the strength that it has.
Right.
And it is self-supporting. So that you can create much, much larger structures at a fraction of the cost.
Right. And just for listeners who are just curious about, hey, how can I read about that? Buckminster Fuller was the one who developed the geodesic dome in the first place. So you can go to the library, you can go online, you can find, you know, several books. I checked a book out from Buckminster Fuller after I interviewed you for that story and kind of read some of it. Fascinating guy.
Oh,
fascinating
he was.
Concepts.
He had a million ideas out there.
Some of them work, some of them don't.
Some
like
of them
like all
do not
ideas.
Work. Yes,
like all
right.
ideas, yeah. So Daniel, here we go now. I've already told you in advance what the key question is here. So what is the most important decision you ever made in your life?
When I was about 19, I decided that I wanted to live intentionally. I was a student at OU, and really I could have gone any direction at that point. I had a great love of history, but I also was enjoying the introduction to engineering that I was doing. But I realized that an engineering career was something that I could make a difference in people's lives with, that it was something that I enjoyed the technical challenge, but it was something that I could be really good at. That decision to be good to myself was something that didn't come naturally. I had a tendency to be pessimistic,
mm-hmm.
and I had a tendency to be self-sacrificial mm-hmm. just for the sake of being self-sacrificial.
Right.
But at about that time was when I met the woman who I would eventually marry. And deciding to pursue that relationship was the first major decision that I made where I knew I was doing something really good for myself.
Wow.
It was an easy decision. I have children now who are who are teenagers and will be adults very soon. And for me to think of them finding their mate at such a young age, I think is kind of crazy. but in the case of my relationship with my wife, it was mm-hmm. something that came very naturally. Mm-hmm. We married very young. We had our children very young.
How old were you when you had your first child?
I was 22.
Okay, yeah.
Which,
not like 15.
No, not like 15.
My background is as a public school teacher, so I've had plenty of students who had their first child when they were 15, 16
right.
years
and,
old.
And,
so, yeah.
And, you know, I think about my grandmother who was married on her 16th birthday.
Right, that's which was very common.
Right.
Yeah, very common in some cultures.
But at the time, and now looking back, I realize, my goodness, we were young.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the timing on that worked out really well.
Yeah.
And that decision to not live in fear, that decision to take risks and to pursue something that's kind of idealistic has paid off. I didn't make the decision to leave Oklahoma City flippantly.
Yeah.
I was there for 8 years, and I was in engineering consulting for a good 10 years before that, building my skill level, building relationships in the
right.
community. And when the time was right, I was able to have the confidence to go out on my own and to have the support system of my family, which was a tremendous benefit to me.
So where did college and engineering school fit in to your relationship with your wife there? Kind of talk about the timeline there a little bit. Did you guys get married while you were in college or after college?
I was wrapping up my bachelor's degree. She had just finished college.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah.
We were able to balance that school and family nicely. As soon as I married her, my grades shot up immediately.
Why is that? You know, I hear that story a lot. Why do you think that was?
Well, you know, for someone to have your back, you know, they're also
yeah.
keeping you honest.
Yeah.
And I realized that I needed to be serious about this. Mm-hmm. And so a little less goofing off and a mm-hmm. little more taking care of business.
Strong. So you found in your life that a strong relationship strengthened you in a lot of different ways, but it wasn't just what she gave to you, it's what you it actually transformed you as you gave to her.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what is her name, by the way?
Her name is Suzanne Wade.
Suzanne. Mm-hmm. Okay. We didn't want to talk about that other person like she's some secret person.
That woman. Yeah.
Somebody out there. Yeah. Well, now, so that was the most important decision that you made there. And it came, but it sounds like it came out of your decision not to live a life of fear. You know, when you talked about fear, that you're not going to live fearfully, that is critical to starting any new anything, isn't it?
That fear was so much more than fear of my personal security or
right.
fear of am I going to be able to keep a job. It was more of an existential fear.
Yeah.
For someone in my position who was environmentally minded, it was easy to get overwhelmed with everything that was going wrong in the world.
Right.
And
that's really easy when you become very aware of the environment. That's kind of the first thing that happens for a lot of people, isn't it?
That's right. It's easy to get overwhelmed, to throw your hands up and
it's
say,
like, my God, we're all just going to die here, you know.
Right.
We're all going to die, kind of thing. Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, I talk a lot about Buckminster Fuller, not only as the pioneer of these geodesic domes.
Right.
There's some dispute as to whether he's the inventor or not, but it certainly wouldn't have happened without him.
Right.
So much of his personal philosophy
right.
was that we had tremendous opportunities in the world that we have and the resources that we have to overcome any ecological challenges that came through.
Right.
And one thing that he always said was that for the first time in history, man has the ability to become a success in his environment.
Wow.
And I had to read that over and over and over again, because it went against everything that I had. It went against this instinct of fear that I had.
Wow.
He was never someone that said, well, technology is going to save everything. He knew that there had to be proper policy behind it.
Right.
But he also felt that there were enough people out there like him that were actively pursuing solutions to environmental problems, that we had the chance to create sustainability. And this was before the word sustainability was used by anybody, to create a sustainable world where everyone was able to live a life of dignity and of security.
Yeah. So we have the young Daniel Wade. How would you characterize yourself as a preteen and a teenager coming up on that encounter with Buckminster Fuller's ideas?
I was very much, I was a very quiet, very studious teen. I was attracted to math from an early age and just had a head for it, but I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And everyone said, oh, you should be an engineer. You should be an engineer. And the more that I got to meet engineers and see what they did, I said, I don't think this is for me.
But you ended up being an engineer.
Yeah, wouldn't you know it.
But once you release something, then you hit and you understand it's a choice, then sometimes you go ahead and choose it anyway, don't you?
Sometimes it just works out that
way. Yeah, that's the way it worked for you, yeah. So you're a pessimistic young man, probably because you could see much more clearly than your peers what was wrong with things, right?
Well, yeah, this was... I'm 16 years old. It's 1989, 1990. Earth Day is first coming back in a big way.
Yeah.
You know, Exxon Valdez had just happened, and our generation was starting to see what is going on.
Yeah. Now, Exxon Valdez, for those who don't know, was
you do have a younger audience than I'm used to. Exxon Valdez in about 1989 was an oil tanker spill in Alaska.
Yeah, the Exxon Valdez was a giant oil tanker. It's still in the courts in a lot of ways, you know, from that. But it was a giant. It ended up in a giant oil spill when that tanker ran aground, and it was a probably one of the first great big giant oil spills. We've had others since then, but it was kind of a moment in time there, wasn't it, for the environment?
It was. There were certainly other oil spills before it, but this was the first one where there was enough photography out there that got released to the public that it really spurred action. You know, they talk about how Vietnam was not the biggest war, but it was the most documented war.
Yeah.
And Exxon Valdez was very much that same way, that all of a sudden the public was seeing these oil-covered birds.
Right.
They were seeing polluted water supplies and saying, what is going on here?
Plenty of room for pessimism for an intelligent young man that reads the papers, watches the news probably.
Right.
Plenty of room for pessimism there. But your story is a story about deciding to turn from that. Is that what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I realized that while there was plenty of cause for pessimism, and if that was the approach you wanted to take, you could do that and no one would call you a fool. and at the same time, the optimism movement of the late 80s rang hollow.
Right.
A lot of it would came off of this whole positive thinking movement. There was a lot of Norman Vincent Peale influence for people who know who that is.
Yeah.
That it was almost like your choices were complete despair or some cotton candy philosophy where everything was going to magically be all right.
So then enter your reading of one of Fuller's books.
Mm-hmm. In 1991, I got a copy, kind of a long story, that I got a copy of Fuller's book called I Seem to Be a Verb.
Right.
And if you ever find a copy, grab it, because they are selling for about $80 online. I got mine for 5 cents. It still has the sticker on it.
The last time I looked, like, you know, Amazon had a used copy of that, and it was like close to $200.
Yeah, it was a treasure hunt.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And one of these days, the Buckminster Fuller Institute will republish it.
Yeah.
But it's a strange little book. It's almost like a comic book.
Wow.
The way that it integrates text and pictures and what seem like random quotes. Mm-hmm. At one point, you have to turn the book upside down and read it again from from the back to the front, and there are reasons behind that that okay. The book explains. But this book really introduced me to Fuller's works, mm-hmm. not just his technical works, but his philosophy. Mm-hmm. Fuller created many terms that we take for granted today, such as spaceship Earth.
Right.
He was the first one to come up with that concept that we were all in this together.
Yeah.
He created the word ecology.
Wow. See, a lot of people don't. I wouldn't have known that unless I'd interviewed you about that earlier on.
You'd have thought that word was 100 years old.
Yeah, it was 100 years old, yeah.
But
yeah.
But he very much took this movement that he had no political influence, but he had technical skill, right. And he could devote his life to using that technical skill to improve mankind.
Right.
And he said, if the technology is there, then the politics don't matter. He said, every nation has embraced the transistor radio.
Right.
And he said, similarly, every nation will embrace desalination.
Yeah. Well, because it's becoming pretty obvious we're going to have to.
And we need now. To.
Yeah.
The time's come.
So you read this book that is really a quite hopeful book. You know, the Fuller book that I picked up, you know, had a lot of kind of technical stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember looking, just kind of skipping through it and going, this is really a very hopeful kind of approach. This is a very positive approach to change and possibility, right?
Absolutely.
Is that what was really transformative about that reading of that book and those decisions that you made, that decision to change your outlook on life?
It's funny because I made that decision based in large part on what I read in his book. And after I had lived my life that way for a while, I started reading more and more of his works. And I found independently that he had gone through a very similar process.
Wow.
That he was bankrupt. He
yes.
had a sick child. He had no business prospects. He didn't see a lot of hope for the future. And he one day just sat down by the shore of Lake Michigan and decided that he was going to live a life of intentionality.
Right.
That he was going to treat his entire life as a scientific experiment, mm-hmm. about how to see what one man, without any outside funding and support, and without any, how did he put it, without any extraordinary technical skills, how one man's life could make an impact on the world at large.
Right, right, right. So now, so jump from there now. How did that encounter and that decision, how did that open the way for your eventual marriage to Suzanne?
The marriage to Suzanne was something that was so easy, that was such a natural decision, that the gloomy, pessimistic Daniel would have said, this doesn't look right.
It's just too easy. It's too easy. It can't be real.
Right.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's an old Paul Simon song that says, I can't get used to something so right. And I played that over and over when we were recording, because it just summarized what I had. And she's an extraordinary woman, and mm-hmm. I'm extremely lucky to have found her and to have somehow convinced her to stick with me. But yeah, it was a new act for me in doing what was best for me,
right,
and not feeling guilty about that.
Wow. Yeah. Or not running away from it.
Because or not you running away.
Just didn't trust. Yeah, you would have, your earlier self would have just not trusted how good that felt, right? This can't be real. I must be just tricking myself here.
Intelligent
people do that a lot.
They do.
They? Yeah.
It's either I'm tricking myself, or you can get trapped in this fallacy of a zero-sum game.
Wow.
That if this is working out so well for me, it must be bringing her suffering.
Yeah, well, I imagine that is the way a pessimist goes at
right.
something like
and,
that,
and,
isn't it?
And so being in that relationship has taught me so much about love.
Wow.
And how love is something that improves the lives of both people.
Right.
And there is love in the work that I do as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be easy to look at what I'm doing and saying, oh, you're trying to put coal out of business, or oh, this is an oil and gas state, why are you trying to hurt our economy? And right. and it's not that kind of thing.
Right. It's not an attack.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, when they built the first bridge across the Mississippi River,
yeah,
it lasted one day. Because on the day that it opened,
yeah,
a bunch of steamboats rammed into it because they said, you're trying to put the ferries out of business. Now, if we kept with that thinking, if every time you drove over to Memphis, you had to park your car on a ferry.
Right.
Where would we be?
But that's always kind of the natural thing, isn't it? When you see new competition come along, the tendency is just to try to wipe it out. Wipe out the competition. Get rid of it.
Well, and there are benefits to that.
You
can often wipe out the competition by producing a better product, producing a cheaper product,
yeah,
and everybody wins.
Yeah.
But sometimes you try to crush the competition by pretending that we are not a dynamic society.
Right.
The changes that we're seeing are extraordinary.
Right.
And people often lift up, you know, personal electronics or that kind of thing as an example of change. But that's just one piece of the pie.
Right.
Everything is changing. The amount, for instance, that the drop in cost of solar panels in the past 8 years has been a game changer.
Right. Yeah.
If it keeps dropping, then projects like the Downdraft Dome, we're going to go out of business, and we're going to be thrilled to have it because the solar panels have finally arrived.
Right.
And we need to be able to embrace that change.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of Oklahomans who are very receptive to that.
Right. So has your marriage been kind of rehearsal for you? You know, we are what we repeat over and over again. Was the positiveness of that marriage kind of rehearsal for not living a fearful life? Because, you know, a lot of people just probably have had the same kind of dreams that you've had about something really big like that, but they're just too fearful to pursue it. And you've, of course, you have some fears, I'm sure, connected with it,
mm-hmm.
but you can't do something like that when your fears dominate you, can you?
I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I've always seen the encouragement that Suzanne has given me. Being able to make that decision and to pursue a successful marriage,
right,
that has taught me a lot about business.
Yeah.
It's taught me that you can succeed while doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and even in college, doing better in college, you know, you're already rehearsing what it meant to be in a relationship. You know, really, most of the things that we do is kind of a relationship, isn't it?
Yeah.
That model Downdraft Dome that you're building outside of Oklahoma City right now, that you know, you have a relationship with that, don't you? I mean, that's a sort of a relationship with the idea, with the concept, with the hope that it'll work. All of that. That's kind of a relationship, isn't it?
It is, and you know, every engineering project I've worked on has been interrelated in so many different ways.
Yeah.
There's so many pieces to the puzzle that have to come together. And it's not a thing where everything has to be perfect, but there are so many factors that have to come into play
for
something like that to go together. For this dome, I have not only the structural challenges of the design, I have the construction challenges of some engineer like me who has to pay someone to get his toilet fixed. Putting together a dome that's 25 feet tall pretty much on my own.
Right.
Then I've got the funding challenges behind it. Uh-huh. And then I've got the technical aspect of this downdraft process that I've had to master. Mm-hmm. So it's many, many different things that have to come together. And without what I've learned as a husband, I couldn't have done it, not just from the confidence point, but from the relationship point, very much so.
Yeah, that was really kind of the first big rehearsal for you as a young man, for really rehearsing living a positive life that's not fearful. Because if you'd been negative and fearful, you probably never would have been in that relationship.
Oh, it's paralyzing.
Yeah.
I would have seen that it was a good thing for me to do,
right?
But I would have done nothing about it.
You would have sabotaged it some kind of way.
And I realized years later, and this is true of anything,
right?
Making no decision is still a decision.
Oh absolutely, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
And so
that is its own decision.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm not going to decide is a decision.
Right.
A lot of people forget that part, don't they?
And when you look at the environmental costs of a project, you also have to ask yourself, what is the environmental cost of doing nothing?
Which is often forgotten.
Yes, but we have mountains of evidence on what is happening as a result of us doing nothing on the clean energy front.
Well, Daniel, we're out of time. We usually try to hold this podcast around 30 minutes. I could spend the next 3 hours talking to you.
We'd have to take several
restroom breaks or whatever. But maybe sometime in the future we can come back and kind of do a reprise on this once you've had more time to develop the downdraft dome a little bit more. And as you see your children grow also, that would be a good conversation in a year or so, two 5 years from now. So, Daniel Wade, thank you very much, and we want to thank Clarity Coffee for allowing us to take up some table space here. We always appreciate them being gracious hosts. Thank you, Daniel Wade, for meeting with me, and this has been a fascinating conversation. Much luck to you in all that you're doing.
Thank you, Brett. If your listeners want to see how the project is going, I give constant updates at 405dome.com. I've finished the fundraising part of that, and so now you'll start seeing construction photos, you'll start seeing some technical data as the summer goes on, and we'll see what the next step is on this technology.
Very good. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Brett.
That concludes our interview. There are several ways for you to catch this weekly podcast. Go to our website at intersectionsok.com, where you can subscribe, listen to episodes, read the backstory, and see photos of our guest. On iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and our Facebook page, we are Intersections Oklahoma. On Twitter and Instagram, we are Intersections OK. I always want to hear about the cool people in your life, so write to me. My email address is ideas@intersectionsok.com. Steven Tyler is our awesome production advisor, and I am your host, Brett Dickerson.